Welcome to Art for All, sponsored by Sketchbook School. As a thank you for joining us, I'd like to give you a free ebook and our monthly newsletter full of tips, recommendations, and other cool stuff. Just head over to sketchbookschool.com to claim your freebies and to learn more about our classes and workshops and our membership program. We believe that art is for everyone, and I hope our podcast inspires you to create and explore your own artistic journey. Thanks for listening. On with the show. Hi there, and welcome to Art for All, the Sketchbook School podcast. I am Danny Gregory, and I am the founder of Sketchbook School, and I am an artist, a writer, a man about town. And I'm joined each week by my friend John Muir Laws, who is a man about the forest. Jack, introduce yourself.
Hey, back from the woods to make this call. I'm John Muir Laws. I am a scientist with a sketchbook, and Danny's conversation buddy for dives into all things art and where it takes us from there.
True. Chat pal, I prefer. Chat pal.
Chat pal.
Chat pal. Pod pal. Yes, we. So what we do is we get together every week and we talk about We try to adhere to a subject, but we often meander as if we were wandering. I imagine us like strolling through the glade, you know, maybe with walking sticks, maybe hands in pockets, wandering past babbling brooks and sylvan
thickets. Got to be thickets.
Sylvan thickets. Yeah. Beating our way through thickets with machetes.
And there we go.
Along the way, talking about art, about life, about, I don't know, stuff, science, things. So today we will do the same. Today, we always pick a subject, as I said, and today's subject is, I guess, what I'm calling inspiration. Inspiration. So what role does inspiration play in our role, in our lives as creative people? And I guess that could include inspiration as in the muse coming down and inspiring us, but it could also include what do we do to really to keep things, to keep the juices flowing, to keep the pot bubbling. And, you know, when I look at my own practice as a creative person, I spend a lot of time looking and reading stuff, looking at stuff and reading stuff. I kind of consider that almost a half of my job, really. But I know that not everybody does. But I remember writing an essay a while ago called Soup. And it was about this notion that my brain is sort of a cauldron that I'm constantly throwing stuff into. You know, I'm always gathering new ingredients and throwing them into the pot. And as they're in the pot, they kind of start to break down and to merge and spice the stew and, you know, interact with the other things that are already in the stew pot. And then out of those things, new stuff comes about, right? That, you know, and sometimes something might stay there for, if something stays there for a really long time and you never taste it, it might completely dissolve and disintegrate and vanish, but it might have a little tiny, tiny flavor that it's added to the mix. And if it's too new, it might kind of rise to the surface and be sort of have too much influence and be too important. But with time, it mellows and seasons the pot. Does that make sense to you?
It does. It does. I like that. I like the sort of idea of your brain as this stew pot, because it kind of gets away from the metaphor of your brain as a fort that you built at some point and then you have to kind of defend, or that it's a static thing. The stew pot is something that is constantly changing. And so I think that's a really accurate, sort of neurologically accurate part of that metaphor. And also I love your idea of, you know, you got to keep feeding the stew pot. And I think that that's that's huge, to always be sort of the lifelong learner. And it's not like you get to some point and then you're done, either with learning or with skill development. What you're trying to do is experiment with interesting threads, bring them into the pot. And you're right, you don't know where those things are going to go. For a while, a bunch of people had to kind of, there's this idea that, you know, to grow your brain, you should play these online video games, and it will increase it'll make you smarter, and kind of improve your working memory and all these other sorts of things. And so all these really bold claims, inaccurate claims were made about playing these video games. And they had, you know, they had sort of sciencey sounding names, but really they're just trying to get seniors to play video games. And it turns out that on the claim that this will grow neural connections in your brain was accurate, but you grow them around playing those video games. And
I see. So you become more adept just at this one skill. Which is not,
yeah. It's not. And the claim was that this is going to transfer over into all these other things that you want to do. And, but there just wasn't any evidence for that claim. And now that people have tested it, we find that there, it's not only that there's no evidence, it just doesn't work that way. Like if you start playing video games a lot, you get really good at playing video games. and that's not going to sort of generally improve your working memory and these other sorts of things. So the sorts of things that you want to throw into the stew pot, you want to kind of look for things that will be kind of multi-purpose tools, where it's not just kind of a one-trick pony that you're going to get good at playing this video game that then when you turn the video game off, it's not going to do anything for you. You know, here the obvious example is learning to draw, because it's this multi-purpose tool that you can bring into how you think about things, how you remember things, how you take lists, all the sorts of visualization. The more you develop that skill, that skill itself is really multifaceted. And so it actually does end up being something with lots of useful angles and directions that you can take it, kind of unlike the claim of playing the video game. But so, yeah, constantly trying to put things into that stew pot that are going to just kind of shake your cage a little bit, rattle your etch-a-sketch. Ideally, you're also tossing in ingredients that might challenge the status quo of how you are thinking and experiencing things.
I think a lot of times when you're learning something, you think that if you study a lot of things around that subject, that will do it, you know? So if you wanted to learn to play the violin, that you would, you know, watch YouTube videos of people playing the violin, that you would listen to a lot of recordings of people playing the violin, that maybe you would learn how violins are made, you know, you would read books about violin playing, you would ideally practice the violin a lot. But then you might find that the most interesting violinists are also chefs, or are also, have friends who play the electric guitar. So a lot of times the influences that make what you do, your creativity, more interesting are not linear, but really the greatest aspect of creativity is this ability to repurpose and recombine things from very different areas and apply them. So I think I'm always surprised by people who are creative people, and they'll say, you know, you mention a movie or a TV show or a book or a museum show, even something that is in the arts field. And they'll say, yeah, I don't I don't go to museums, or I don't watch TV. I don't have time to read books. And I always think, so are you saying that because you're showing me how focused you are on your discipline, and that's why you're a serious artist, because all you do is that? When for me, it's about the multiplicity of things. I mean, again, maybe I'm not as accomplished a draftsman as I would have been if I just focused on just drawing. But I think in the end, our job as artists is really to shed new light on things, right? And it may be that you're showing a universal truth, but you're showing it in a new way. And that new way that you're showing it may be influenced by a really unusual thing. Like, you might have read an article in The New Yorker about a brain surgeon, and the way that he talks about his tools might inspire you to think about your brushes differently. There's this stew is not just, you know, a chicken vegetable stew. It can be a stew that has, you know, Indian spices in it, and it has, you know, some bits of grass in it, and it has lots of, you know,
Tinker toys.
I'm not sure about that part, but yes, theoretically, yes. So I think that's really the challenge, is to keep open-minded in this way, open-minded to the influences that virtually anything can have on you, you know. Hold on a second. That's really what, to me, is also interesting. It's also interesting, you know. I mean, I remember in my years in advertising, how many advertising creative people I would meet who only could reference advertising. So, you know, you would say, you know, did you see this movie? And they would say no. But then their references would be other commercials. I would always think, and I would say, well, have you ever seen this movie directed by Wes Anderson? And they would say, do you think we could get Wes Anderson to direct the commercial? I'd say, no. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm just saying we can take something from that, or we could take something from the style in which a story is told on a podcast, or we could take, you know, a story by de Maupassant, and we could say, this makes me think of this. That I think just makes you a more interesting person, frankly, too. And it doesn't necessarily mean that your references are obscure, because I think that's also another problem with art making, is are you going to be overly intellectual or overly sort of twee in your references, that it's going to seem like, this isn't for me because I don't understand. I don't know who de Maupassant was. So you say, well, okay, it doesn't really matter. There are universal truths that we find in art. And even if you don't understand the reference, you could still understand the truth. Just a thought.
Right. Yeah. My working definition of creativity kind of ties into this. I think of creativity itself as your brain's ability to make meaningful connections between seemingly unrelated things.
Yes.
And so you want to be exposed to a lot of things, and then you want to practice, how is this like that? How is this different than that? How are, you know, with those similarities, is that just sort of a surface thing, or is that kind of a deeper process thing? But really intentionally working on trying to draw relationships between things, so trying to get your brain to be a connector.
Right. And to shed different kinds of light on it, right? I mean, I would imagine as a scientist that being able to have a variety of different perspectives on a thing, on a problem, makes it that much more likely that you're going to come up with an interesting and possibly correct solution, right? Because you're thinking outside the box, quote unquote. You know, you're bringing in just new tools, new lenses.
And that's also, you know, part of the advantage of science is a team sport, right? You've got everything that's happening in your brain. There's the person down the hall. there's, you know, your scientists are constantly reading the things of other scientists. Scientists are then riffing off of those ideas and citing the other people in their work. Now in elementary school, we're teaching kids how to collaborate. How do you work with other people on a project to get things done? Because at the, just about like the idea of the scientist as the kind of mad lone scientist off in their lab with test tubes burbling and kind of cackling is an inaccurate trope. Right. That's right. That's the kind of the common trope of the scientist as this loner.
And the artist. But, and the artist, yeah. And the writer. Same thing. Sitting in a cabin, sitting in a garret.
You know? Yes. That's right. But you think of like the major movements in art, it's not some person just sitting there by herself. Right. It's these people getting together then in the coffee shop and kind of geeking out with the, like, whoa, did you see what Francesca did today? Oh man, that's some crazy. And then they're riffing off of each other.
Right. But I think that's because of marketing and capitalism. Like you want to be able to tell a simpler story. So you want to be able to say Thomas Edison invented the light bulb. You want to say that, you know, Monet invented impressionism. You want to say that Andy Warhol invented pop art. You know, you want to be able to find a person, and then you want to be able to reduce that person to basically a two-dimensional cartoon. But that's not really...
That little two-dimensional cartoon is also an inaccessible genius.
Right.
Right? It's not somebody who's involved in process.
You couldn't do this because you haven't got the magic. Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. So
how do you feed your stew pot? How do you kind of look for nuggets to kind of toss into the stew pot of Danny?
I think I spend a lot of time in rabbit holes, and you know, I like rabbit stew. No, I spend a lot of time.
Yes.
I spend a lot of time like going on, you know, roads less traveled to some extent. Finding a thing, it leads me to another thing. I'm rarely thinking about the utility of the thing. You know, there are times that my inner critic will say, what are you wasting all this time on this thing for? You know, this has nothing to do with the task at hand. I spend a lot of time on the internet. Obviously, the internet is an endless trove of stuff. The thing about the internet is there's a lot of crap. And there's a lot of erroneous information. But I'm not really looking for verifiable facts most of the time. A lot of times I'm interested in like, how did this person explain this thing? Even though the thing that they're explaining has nothing to do with what I want to explain. But I think really the core of my creative output is generally in essays that I write, and essays that are often, at their core, probably not saying something you haven't necessarily heard before, because I think most, you know, a lot of essays are like that. But what I try and do is I try and tell it in a way that is unusual, or I'll try and tie it to something that feels relevant. You know, so I might want to write an essay that says something along the lines of, you should go out and feed your brain and get lots of information and be open-minded. So let's say that that's my thesis. Again, you've heard that before. A million people have said it. So I might say it in terms of a stew pot, right? So why do I say it in terms of stew pot? I say it in terms of stew pot because I think that there are a lot of interesting things in cookbooks. And I read cookbooks. And I watch television shows about cooking. And we know people who are chefs. My wife and I go to restaurants and try lots of different kinds of food. So food might be a natural way of combining, a natural sort of metaphoric language to apply to something that's kind of different, right? So if I'm talking about drawing or I'm talking about writing, but I'm applying cooking language to it, it just makes you think and engage with me as you're reading it, where you're trying to figure out the metaphor. You know, or you might be delighted and surprised by a twist or a turn that I apply. So that something that is on some level familiar has a new way of absorbing it. Because I think so many of the things that art and literature are trying to convey are things that you've been told 100 times, but for some reason they didn't stick. Mm-hmm. So I need to tell it to you in a new way. And, you know, and you think about, there are these books that I've seen that are like lists of story plots. And they say, you know what, there's 100 plots, or there's 30 plots, or there's 8 plots, or whatever it is. There's only so many plots, and you can take anything in literature and basically winnow it down to those plots. And so you think, well, why is it entertaining then to read a book if you kind of know how it's going to turn out because there's only 8 plots? Well, because of the way in which it's presented. Anyway, so I'm reiterating my same point, which is I look for lots of different influences. So I like, as I said, I spend time on the internet, but I like to read essays. I read a lot of essays and newsletters, and I subscribe to a lot of newsletters. I like to read things about science. I read things about art. I read things about marketing. I read things about sort of technology, sort of, sort of sociology kinds of things that are explaining how people behave, how culture behaves. I like to read history, and I like to read trash sometimes, you know, like read like a thriller or something. And similarly, like with music, there came a point where, you know, you had access to all the music in the world, right? And so you no longer were just listening to your LP collection, but you can go on Spotify and you can listen to literally anything ever recorded. But the problem is, well, how do you do that? I mean, what do you listen to, right? So then Spotify will say, well, based on your listening history, we recommend this. And a lot of times what they're recommending may not be very good, or maybe just kind of exactly what I just listened to, but just like a different recording of it or something. And I'm interested in new experiences. And I've always found that the radio rarely presents me with anything new. You know, it's like if you listen to Top 40 or whatever it is, you listen to classic rock, it's all the same playlists over and over again. So we now listen to a radio station, a streaming radio station that's eclectic music, but it's French. So it's not all French music, but it has a French point of view, which is really, really different. And you never know what you're going to hear. You might hear a piece of classical music followed by some jazz, followed by a French popular piece of music, followed by some kind of, classic blues song, whatever it is. It's always different. And so it's always surprising. So you pay attention. Music doesn't just become a background bed, but it's something that's a listening experience. And I think it's been a long time since I've been able to do that. The old days of like putting on a record and sitting there and listening to it. And it's not necessarily that you need the music, but you need the experience of paying attention, you know, paying attention to anything that you're experiencing. It's so easy in our world to be numbed, to be overwhelmed. So that's what I find useful.
So you're talking, I love that you're thinking about how to avoid just sort of numbing and not really engaging with what you're experiencing. You've got a strategy for getting out of the echo chamber of the algorithm. That whether you've got your computer set up to track what you like and what you click on, it of course just feeds you more of that. And especially around things that are a little bit emotionally charged, it's even more effective at doing that. And so we end up just sort of convincing ourselves that we're right, rather than investigating whether we may be wrong about something.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like politics or culture in general. You know, part of us wants the familiar. We want, you know, we don't want to be challenged. You know, we want people who are of like minds, and we want to listen to the oldies, and we want, you know, comfort food. And we want what we know, but that's not really helpful, because all that does is it's the same thing. It's Campbell's tomato soup instead of this bubbling cauldron of stew. Yes. You know, it's like, yeah, that's my mother used to make me Campbell soup when I was cold and when I was sick and home from school. Okay, fine. Nostalgia is fine in its place, but you've got to venture out and you've got to make yourself uncomfortable and you've got to challenge yourself. I think this is the thing a lot of times is, why does anybody like this? I'm sure you've had this experience, like maybe the first time you had sushi, let's say, and you know, you were like, what? Like, what? People eat this, or people listen to this music, or people, you know, what? And you can put up those blocks and just go like, those people are idiots, or those people are pretentious, or those people are foreign, or whatever it is. You can easily come up with a reason why you shouldn't experience it. But if you do experience it,
and just wanted to interject, and it's also interesting, a big way of kind of negating that is once you can kind of come up with a sort of a pejorative label for whatever that is, then it's easier for your brain to kind of categorically not pay attention to that.
Right. Because you can say, I don't need to think about that. It's safe to not think about that. I mean, again, that goes back to the inner critic, to the monkey, to, you know, to the way that our brain is structured to avoid the unfamiliar. I mean, it is a strategy for survival, right? The unfamiliar definitely has danger involved with it.
Is a threat. That's right.
But I think when you look at artists, or writers or musicians who just work in the familiar, I can't tell you how many times, I read an awful lot of books, and there's so often that you'll pick up a book and you start reading it and you'll go, well, have I read this before? Or you'll say, well, okay, that character is like cut out of cardboard in two dimensions, or okay, that dialogue is completely doesn't seem real. Like nobody would ever say that. All those kinds of things are happening where that is basically working with familiar tropes where the characters are all stereotypes. And, you know, that exists in every art form, is the super familiar, which may be the most popular. It may be a great way to make a living, right? Make a certain kind of action movie or a certain kind of rom-com, mm-hmm. or, you know, mm-hmm. paint, you know, like in a way that's going to be popular on Instagram. There's so many ways to do things that people are going to like this. But, you know, I think as artists, it kind of becomes dull fairly quickly. And, if you don't come up with something original, then anybody can do what you do. And so you become much less part of the conversation because you're just a cliche. So we want to, you know, from a sort of career point of view, you want to be an original, but you may not want to be so unusual that people reject you because they can't immediately put you into a category. Some of those are things we have to consider as artists. Where do we want to be? But I think when it comes to the type of stuff that we ingest, don't live on fast food. And fast food is, you know, could mean a certain kind of mystery novel. It could mean a certain kind of pop music. It could mean a certain kind of, you know, cute illustration styles. There's a lot of fast food, and it may not be good for you.
And I also want to sort of think about this idea of, you know, things that are the sort of the value of doing something new and original. And I guess I would think that it is okay if somebody else has done this before, but I'd say the important thing is that it's new and pushing boundaries for my brain.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because there's nothing absolutely new under the sun, but there's your version of it, you know?
Right.
Like I was listening to this eclectic French radio station that I was mentioning this weekend, and somebody had done a slow acoustic cover of a Bee Gees song. You know, you can tell by the way I walk, I'm a ladies' man, no need to talk.
Yes.
But imagine that, being sung really slowly and played like on the ukulele or something. And it was absolutely beautiful. And I was like, this is so familiar in a way, but it's completely different. And it made me think differently about the Bee Gees song and the decisions that they made about this song, a song that every one of us knows. It's like in your marrow, every, you know, Bee Gees song from Saturday Night Fever. But to hear it completely in a new way was startling. So I'd never said to myself, oh, they're just doing that stupid Bee Gees song. No, I was like, that's genius, you know? And I remember in Wes Anderson's movie, The Life Aquatic, he uses this, all the music is made by the same Brazilian artist who does covers of David Bowie songs. And every one of them is absolutely beautiful and makes you rethink David Bowie and rethink everything about Brazilian music. And you think, like, God, it's just like this merger of these two very different things that create something absolutely new and beautiful.
Yeah. And so when we're in that zone, your brain is, it, our brain is so excited by things that are novel. And it's easier for us to focus in that zone. I think also that, and again, the distinction, I think the distinction is really important, that it is okay if other people have done this before. It is okay if other people have thought of these things before. I don't have to say, like, I'm going to just have to be so wild and different, like nobody's ever gone here before. But what I'm doing is I'm intentionally pushing my brain out of the comfortable rut that it likes, you know, sliding around on. And I'm trying to get my brain, my little pot of stew, to burble a different flavor than it has before. And so that's going to also involve, let's say at some point I get a really good soup. I think it's really easy to start thinking, I've got things figured out. I'm right. This is good enough. And then anything that challenges those ideas is a threat. If you start identifying with your soup, then changing the soup is a threat. And so I'm going to say that part of the idea of the soup is that the soup, you want to keep that changing, because just the hubris in the idea of saying that I figured this stuff out and I'm right now, and is absurd at all levels.
Right.
You know, because I know that, you know, 10 years ago, I now disagree with myself about some things that I thought 10 years ago. And I had the same sort of feeling of like, oh yeah, I think I've got stuff figured out 10 years ago. The 40 something Jack thought he had things figured out. The 50 something Jack has the same subjective experience, but probably the 70 something Jack is going to have a different perspective on it. And, so I want to welcome changing the soup. And if I ever start defending the soup from change, then I think I'm missing the point of having my brain.
Yeah. And I think this, it comes back to something we've talked about a long time, lifelong learning, right? You're never, as an artist, you've never like got it all worked out. You've never figured it all out. You don't graduate from art school knowing exactly how to do it. No, it's a lifelong experience. And even if you're not an artist, life is a lifelong experience. Something can happen to you when you're 70 that completely changes your perspective, right? So you have to, I think the cliche of older people is that they're rigid, inflexible, get off my lawn kind of people
the opposite, right?
They don't respond. Well, I mean, there are crotchety old geezers, but generally I think it's like, if you can continue to open yourself up to experiences forever, then, you know, forever young to some extent.
Well, and like about my experience with just with say teaching art, is that people in the middle of their life very often aren't ready to take the risk of trying something new because they want to be shown to all their peers as being competent. And then elders, I've got so many elders in programs that I teach that are like, oh, this is new, this is hard, this is different. Okay, bring it. Because if somebody doesn't like what I do, I'm not as stressed out about that as I used to be. They are like the really young are risk takers because there's no
left to lose.
Sense of death, right? And I wonder if our elders are willing to take more risk for precisely the reason that they are aware of that death, and this is the life that I've got, and I'm going to make the most of it. And so why not learn to paint? Why not?
Yeah, and I think your identity is less tied up with your expertise at that certain point. Like you don't need to validate your existence by showing that you're good at X, Y, or Z. And I think when you're younger, I mean, there's a certain arrogance of young people, cockiness, but I think there's also a more of a willingness to try things because why not? What the hell? Why not? But I think when you're, as you say, when you're middle-aged, you have a lot more to lose by not being credible. And, you know,
it's going to be helpful to your career to be an expert on something.
Right. Yeah, that's true. I think when you're older, you also realize that the things that you've learned, you can share, but you can also be open to, you can also open yourself up to new experiences because maybe you just have more confidence in yourself and saying, you know what, even if I encounter a new experience, a new situation, I'll be able to weather it because I've done that before. You know, I've had lots of ups and downs and, you know, I survive. I can do this. But I do still think though, when you're older, there can still be a lot of calcification and rigidity where you say, I just don't like that. Or you can say, I mean, here's a very common thing. I'm just not a technology person. You know, I don't get technology. I can't figure that stuff out. And there I think, okay, come on. Like you figured out a lot of things in your life. You can't figure out how to use this, turn down the volume on a cell phone. You know, there's a lot of things that you can master at any age. And the fact that it's a bit unfamiliar shouldn't be so daunting to you that you don't try. I mean, I can understand if you're particularly old and your senses are limited and you can't see and hear properly. So then maybe you just feel so much more vulnerable that you're afraid to go into a situation that could cause you harm, that could be risky. But I think for most of us, we're fairly, you know, resilient. And I would like to see more people try more things, listen to more kinds of music, try more kinds of food, go to more kinds of places, meet more kinds of people without your assumption being that they are going to be a certain way. And I think in doing all that, you, again, open up your mind and find new raw material for your creativity. What are some of the things that you do to feed your, I mean, I've been a little bit vague about what I do, but in part because it's not systematic, but what are some of the things you do? Do you just go and like sit under a tree and listen to a bird? What do you do to
fight? That is a big part of my process.
But is that still inspiring to you? Isn't it kind of like how many trees can you sit under? How many birds can you listen to?
All of them. Danny, all of them. Please bring it. What it is you have never sat under this tree on this day and listened to this bird in this way. And so when you that rhymed. I like that. And what I'm challenging myself to do is to be out in the presence of the familiar, but experience the novel in that. So can I get myself to, I can identify all the species that are around me, and there's a part of my brain that then just wants to shut down once I kind of like, oh, I've got that. Oh, I know what that is. You know, like,
got it, check. Got it, need it, got it. Right.
Yes, exactly. But so what I want to do is I want to, here's this, there's this bird that I'm under the tree. I'm listening to the bird. I'm watching this bird. Can I learn something new about this that I've never known before? So for me, in nature, it is an infinitely complex system. And in any little part of that, there you could spend lifetimes scratching the surface of the complexity that is in front of you. And so what I'm trying to do is, by being in nature, I'm using the journal as a tool to push me back past the point where I think I know what's going on, till I'm clearly in this state where, wow, there are all these things happening here that I don't really get and I don't really understand. What can I learn about that by just paying a little bit more attention?
But like yesterday, I was sitting in my backyard and I was looking at the birds on the phone wires that run right behind, between me and my neighbors. And I was looking at them and these pigeons, they were doves, mainly doves. They always space themselves equally. Like they had like a perfect spacing. They're like notes on a staff. You know, they space themselves perfectly. And then if one new one comes along, like they'll all kind of recalibrate, but they just sit there and then they sit there and they, like, I've noticed some things about them. Like they'll often face west. I think that they're like maybe watching the sunset. I don't know, watching the sun move towards the sunset. I don't know what the hell they're doing there. And then I look at them, they're all kind of the same. And, you know, birds in general are insane right now in my yard because it's spring. But in general, I look at them and I go, okay, so I counted them. There were 32. And I thought, okay, there's 32 there. They're sitting there. And then I start anthropomorphizing them. And I'll think, okay, like, this is their whole, like, do they think about the fact that they don't own anything? That they kind of just are sitting there? Like, what are they doing? Do they actually have a home to go to? It's just, they're so present in the moment that it's sort of interesting from that point of view. So I'm looking at them not as like, oh, here's the Latin name for this particular dove. But I'm looking at them as sort of like life forms that are sort of interesting. And it makes me, again, as everything does, think about myself. And just sort of thinking like, yeah, that's sort of interesting. But I don't feel enormously inspired by that. I feel more like I'm trying to come up with an idea by watching them. But that's just sort of my, you know, amateur's perspective on watching them.
Well, I like what you're doing there. I mean, you're looking at this phenomenon. You're noticing all sorts of details instead of like, birds. Well, how many birds? How many birds are going to be there tomorrow? Is this the typical amount that is kind of there? No, they're all pointing in the same direction. Are they facing west? Are they facing the sun? Are they facing into the wind? Is there an advantage to having them all facing the same direction? Would it make more sense to have some pointing in some one direction and others in the other direction? So you could see the peregrine falcon coming.
Just doves, you know, they're not very smart.
Oh, but they're doves. And they're a system that has worked for so long, right? They're a system that works, right?
That's true.
Just think how successful they are. I mean, that whole pigeon thing, it's working pretty well for them.
There's a lot of them. There's a lot of them. They're clearly
doing
much better than the quails. The quails take hits from predators much more readily than the doves do.
So if all the doves are facing the same direction, like with quail, I can hear that there are clear warning calls that you can hear quails giving. They'll make these sort of predator alarm calls, and they'll have a sentinel sitting up on the post. And I don't see rock doves doing that. Right. So why is it then that they're so successful? So see, what's happening here is now my brain is kind of getting curious about this phenomenon. What's up with the phenomenal success of the rock dove? I'm not seeing collective behavior that I'm noticing that seems to help. Is it just that we've created the perfect habitat for them with lots of abundant food, water, and shelter? And so they're going to sort of fill that out, or is there some other strategy that they have? Why is it that I see more quails in the talons of the raptors than rock doves? Like, why aren't there a lot more peregrine falcons just feasting on pigeons? So what's going on there? A big part of my inspiration is the part of my brain that doesn't know stuff. So I like to try to find questions. And for me, that kind of gets me, you mentioned the rabbit holes earlier. When I want to go spelunking down a rabbit hole, this is sort of the process. You kind of get yourself into a question and then it starts gnawing at you. And then that gets me looking at the next group of pigeons and the next group of pigeons. And now I'm really checking out, like, are they all pointing the same direction? What about at different times of the day? So if it's a sun facing thing, like in the morning, are they facing the other way? Right. What about noon when the sun is overhead? I would then expect them to be facing all sorts of different directions.
All right.
And the lower the sun.
But you're doing like scientist qua scientist thinking right now. You're not doing what we've been talking about, which is if you said to me, you know what, I watch airplanes taking off from the airport and that gives me ideas about rock doves. And then I read some Trojan history and that gave me some thoughts about predators. And then I was listening to some African, you know, tribal music and that gave me some thoughts about calls from the wild. Yeah.
Yes. So I think I just once I got started on the pigeons, I couldn't stop. But you're absolutely right. So cross training is really important.
Right.
You know, kind of, it's interesting. You mentioned kind of athletes before, like the athletes that, that just focus in one sport tend not to be the ones who really emerge as the stars, as the ones who cross train. Who, you know, spend a little bit of off-season time doing something different instead of just practicing that one trick that they have. So for cross-training your brain, let's see, things that you mentioned kind of going spelunking down rabbit holes that are not necessarily directly practical. I loved that so much that I had to write it down. Because that also is part of my practice. I like to kind of find something and geek out on it right now. So right now, the thing that has kind of caught my curiosity is cold reading.
What?
Cold reading. So cold reading is what psychics and mentalists do to make you think that they are either speaking with the dead or have some sort of insight into your past and future. And it's a series of kind of psychological hacks and tricks that can give a person a very convincing sense that somebody has psychic powers. And as a way of understanding how our brains are easily tricked and fooled, I've been kind of geeking out on like, what is the system? I think it would be actually really be fun as not to pretend that I can speak with the spirits and the dead, but to get really good at this system so that as sort of a performance, I would be able to do this thing, which is more about probability and paying attention to people's behavior and sort of tricks of how you say things like this, because it's fascinating. It's a fascinating way for me to study kind of the way that humans think by looking at this way that we're easily tricked, because I think I'm tricked by all sorts of things, but here's a whole system for tricking people. Let me give you kind of a fun example of it. Let's say I'm, I'm doing a cold reading on you. Here's this really fun trick. I'm going to say to you, so you weren't born in a dense urban area, were you?
Yes, I was.
I thought so. Because I am, I'm sort of sensing crowds. I'm sensing people. I'm also sensing kind of a diverse environment. All right. So what I did is I didn't say you weren't born in a city, or I didn't say you were born in a city. I said you weren't born in a dense urban area, were you? So weren't and were.
So I could
were
say. Both so I could say why? Yes, I was. Or I could say, how did you know I wasn't? Right.
Right. Exactly. So either way, I'm right. And then I just pretend that that's what I meant. Isn't that cool?
So you could right? So you could run for office. You could become a used car salesman. You could become a lawyer. Well, but, you could do a lot of things with that.
But what it is, it's a strategy. And then I've been looking at, you know, YouTube videos of people pretending to speak with the dead. And they're doing these exact same things. And it is, so that's like, so that does not really relate to my drawing. It kind of, in a one way, kind of relates to my interest as in sort of public understanding of science. You know, how do we trick ourselves? How can we be tricked? But there's not a really direct application.
But I think that's an important point, which is we're not looking for things that have direct applications. In fact, right. I would suggest that that's even less the point than having a thing where you never know where that thing is going to go or where that thing is going to lead to some other thing. It doesn't really matter because these are all things that are going into who you are as a person, things that interest you, and your art, even though you're in a lot of ways, the art that you're making doesn't on the face of it seem to be about expressing everything about you. You're not, your art is a scientific tool by and large. But I would also say that there are things in your art that if somebody looked at them closely, they would, just like you're talking about cold reading, your art might reveal things about you too. Right. So yes. Things that have nothing to do with the bird that you're drawing, but explain, you know, something, you know, and I think you could do that with any piece of art. And a lot of art historians do that, of course. They'll take a painting and they'll break it down and try and analyze it in terms of what does it reveal about the artist and what is, and the artist's influences and those kind of predilections. So I think that it doesn't have to be a direct correlation. It's again going into the stew pot. So you've got like some hucksters floating in your stew pot now.
They're lovable now. These shenanigans. But yeah, so I'm learning the ukulele also for the same reason, is that it's outside of my area of comfort. I'm intentionally doing something that is different.
Well, you mentioned you're doing it with your daughter, so it's also about learning to learn.
Oh yes,
right.
I wanted my two daughters to see me on an uphill slope of a learning curve.
Right.
I've been drawing for a while.
You mentioned that. And I think what's interesting about that is also, and I've talked about clown school often enough, but clown school is a similar thing. Putting yourself into a situation of vulnerability or lack of expertise, particularly when you are an expert. I mean, you and I are both, for better or worse, experts at a certain thing, right? We teach other people to do certain things. But I think constantly being aware of the lack of what it feels like to not know something is a really important part of being able to teach somebody else how to do it. And I've noticed that there are people who teach art who seem completely insensitive to that, you know, and they're very much focused on like, this is the way to do this. And they're less interested in, well, why wouldn't you know that? Or why would you struggle with this particular thing? And the only way I think to get to that empathetic point is by going through it yourself. And perhaps you have to do it in a field that you're not familiar with. But again, it becomes a skill that you can bring back to your core skill, right? And say, because I'm no good at, for instance, I'm learning how to play tennis, which is a nightmare, but I'm learning how to be an expert at this thing. And I'm constantly thinking about playing tennis in terms of drawing and in terms of, and I'm thinking about my coach in terms of me as a coach of other people's creativity. I think, like, what is the thing that he's doing? What is he making me do? How do I feel about that thing that he's making me do? Am I learning something from it? Do I find it terribly tedious? Is it motivating me? All those things, again, completely different application, but they're essential things in it that are really useful in this way. So,
yeah. And also, as another thing that I think we both are into is teaching itself, so that when we are learning one of these new skills, something that I know I really look for is a good teacher.
Right.
And it is, for instance, I was feeling very kind of fixed mindset about part of my ukulele playing. I was feeling stuck and right. And, you know, it's exactly the feelings that I know a number of my students have when they're trying to draw a squirrel. Right? It's like, oh, it's not working for me. And just watching the way that my teacher kind of went into that place where I was feeling, found me and helped pull me out, it took work. It took direct attention. And I was very aware, like, wow, what you just did was really graceful there. That would be really impossible if you're feeling frustrated. And just, it's also just so much fun to, you know, as you're learning things, to be paying attention to how, you know, what are tips there that I can also incorporate into how I, if the next time I encounter a student who's feeling really frustrated.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's a movie called Seymour and Introduction, which is, it's also a book by J.D. Salinger, but it's a movie made by Ethan Hawke, the actor. And Ethan Hawke.
Called Seymour?
Seymour, colon, and Introduction.
Okay.
And it's about I think he developed stage fright at some point, some kind of anxiety thing. And he decided that he would learn to play the piano in order to overcome his stage fright. He just wanted to do something that he wasn't an expert at. And so he studied with this legendary piano teacher called Seymour. I can't remember his last name. And he ended up making a film, which is also something he had never directed a film before. So the film is about this piano teacher who's legendary and why he's legendary and what he gets people to do and how he gets them to think. But it's also simultaneously this this piece of therapy that Ethan Hawke is going through in the process of making it. And it's really great. It's entertaining, definitely worth watching. I think it's available streaming somewhere, probably on Netflix. And it's worth seeing this process of creativity, but also what it is to learn to create in another field and what it is to teach somebody. And Seymour was a well-known pianist, and then he became a teacher. And he's like in his 80s or something. So he's been doing this for a long time. And it's a really, really worthwhile thing. To me, that's a great soup ingredient. You know, here's a film made by an actor about a piano teacher. What's that got to do with drawing? But of course, in so many ways, it is a useful analogy and is full of interesting tidbits. So that fall off the bone as it sits in the pot. So,
I can look for that.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I like films about the creative process. I find that most, when people make movies about artists, they're usually terrible. You know, when they make dramatizations, and they'll say, you know, and you'll have like a lot of people chewing the scenery and a lot of stuff that has nothing to do with art, you know? So it's like about their affairs with their models or their, you know, fighting with their parents because they're supposed to go and get a job in the family company instead of being, there's all these kinds of nonsensical distractions because Hollywood tends to think that the life of an artist in and of itself isn't interesting enough. And so they have to create some other kind of drama around something else. But I think it also contributes to our misunderstanding of artists and the artistic process, you know? So you make a film about Beethoven and it has to be about his trauma over going deaf. You know, you make a movie about Mozart and it has to be about how he was like an idiot child, you know, giggling. You make a movie about Jackson Pollock and it has to be about how he was a drunk and smashed up station, you know, scenery and peed in the fireplace of Peggy Guggenheim. And so you can't just say, you know, what about if we actually study the process of art making? Like, that's actually really interesting. Unfortunately, it may not make a good movie, but it can make a good documentary sometimes. So, you know, so I think we have to take movies about artists with a really large grain of salt, but documentaries that may not even explain the process. Because a lot of times you want a documentary to explain, like, what was he actually thinking? Like, what was he actually doing that he came up with this thing? And it may not be that simple, but it does expose you to the creative process and, you know, maybe a little bit about what they're thinking. Because unfortunately, most artists are really inarticulate in explaining their own process and their own art. And a lot of times they're actually wrong. And a lot of, you know, that's why there are academics and critics to sort of explain what an artist was really trying to do, because the artists themselves make the art instead of explaining it. If you have to explain it, then you might as well not make the art. Right. So.
It's interesting. Now you've got me sort of thinking about, I was thinking originally about sort of how the trope of how scientists are presented in the movies. And then you just came up with a whole list of artists who are also presented in movies as these sort of disturbed.
Artists are always this. Vincent van Gogh. Part of the reason he's popular is because he cut off his ear and shot himself, you know? And then how do you represent Paul Gauguin? Well, you know, he was crazy and he was irascible and he was a drunk and he was, you know, constantly seducing native girls. And you just, you know, Picasso, what was his deal with Picasso? You know, he beat his wives. He just reduced it to something that, yes, that was a part of who this person was. It may not have been a very, you know, savory part of them, but it doesn't really shed any light on their art. That's what we care about. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't really care if you're a genius who picked his nose. I don't want to see a film about nose picking, even though it may make a better movie than somebody stretching canvases.
And what I realize is that also people who have a deep connection with nature as they are presented in movies is also, these people are typically kind of presented as, you know, you're crazy and you're probably going to die, or cut off your hand.
Right.
Whether it's, you know, Into the Wild or Grizzly Man, too much nature is bad for you. So it is interesting to, I've never really kind of thought about all those things at one time before, how all of those fields in movies to make a kind of forgetting box office appeal, you have to sort of find the disturbing angle and wallow in that.
Look, the irony is that movies are made by creative people too. Right? You would think that the creative people who make movies would understand the creative process. They're not, right? It's not, they're not made by like people who don't get it. They totally get it. And I think to some extent they think that the audience is going to be people who don't get it. So therefore, you can't just say what it is. You have to make it into some other thing in order to make it interesting. So, you know, they have to be like fighting with their girlfriends and taking drugs and smashing stuff in order for it to be a movie, which may well be true. I mean, that may be true. It's not entertaining necessarily to watch. You know, I always remember, what was this? There was a book about, forgetting right now, but it was a book written by a critic who sat as for a portrait, Giacometti. And he was just talk about what it was like to sit there in the studio, and he would paint him. And then at the end of the day, he would scrape the canvas, and the next day he would start again. And he just talked about this like day after day, just sitting there. And you think, well, that would not make a good movie, you know? And in a lot of ways, that's kind of what it turns out to be, is maybe you don't want to watch them making the muffins, you know, maybe you don't want to see them making the donuts, as it were. You want to see, you want to eat the donuts. So are there other ways that we can learn from artists by watching movies? I mean, I think there are ways that people have made movies about the creative process, but it was less of a direct biopic and it may have been other aspects of it. So, well, look, I think we've explored this idea. I think there's a lot more to it. I think we can keep going. But I think I'd love to hear from people about how they feed their pot. Like, what do you do to inspire yourself? Do you inspire yourself? Are you broad range? Do you disagree with this theory that you should be omnivorous and not just focus on art techniques, but that you should go and, you know, read all kinds of things and watch all kinds of things and listen to all kinds of things and eat all kinds of things in order to feed yourself as a creative person? And also, what are you seeing coming out of that? Can you ever trace those influences back? Is it important? I think I'd love to hear more about that from you. So if you want to write to us at podcast@sketchbookschool.com, we'd love to know more about what you're thinking. Jack, do you have any other thoughts or questions or requests?
I guess another, just one other thought is for me is that one other sort of part of my practice is, even when I'm not feeling particularly inspired about something, just getting out and doing something, picking up the pencil and making marks, keeps my brain in the game.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's that even without the presence of some direct inspiration, putting in just some more pencil miles, you know, here's a vegetable off my counter and I'm going to, you know, can I make a drawing of it? Can I cut it in half and show the placentation arrangement of the parts inside? Like, what's, you know, whatever it is, even if I'm not, you know, feeling a call of a muse, it doesn't matter. Sometimes just showing up for your pencil, showing up for nature, things will happen.
Yeah. And I would add to that by saying playing. In other words, another source of inspiration can be just like, try something out and see where it goes. Go in some wild direction. That in and of itself can be a source of inspiration. So your variations, your improvisations, they themselves can build you in new directions. They can be stuff that goes into your stew pot where you say, when I was playing, I created a new kind of a line, or I was trying out a new kind of a tool and it made me feel this certain way, or it made a certain kind of stroke that I didn't even know I could make. Those kinds of things, again, it's another form of adding variety to your experience in order to just spark new sort of associations and new mergers of stuff that may never have been done before. That may be where your originality comes from, something that you couldn't anticipate or plan. But you just, you know, like I was saying before, you play a standard song, but you play it on a kazoo. It's never been done that way before. And suddenly, you know, you're making magic. So, all right. Well,
my final thought, I'm sensing that there's a listener with, I'm either getting an M or a G name, an M or a G name. You know who I'm talking to? There's a scar on your knee. So if that's true, this is for you. I know you have a sense of that you have untapped potential that you have never really stepped into. We would love to hear from you in the comments about what you use for inspiration in your journal and how you find that.
It's amazing. It's an uncanny gift you have. It's
uncanny. It's uncanny.
It's Laws the Magnificent. He reads your mind. I'm getting a signal. I think you like listening to podcasts. or possibly right. watching them on YouTube. I'm just getting a very strong sense of that. And you know, if you are, please identify yourself, because we might have some more things that we can tell you about.
We'd really like to hear from you.
Yes. All right. Well, I think with that, that's enough tomfoolery for one day.
That's enough today.
This has been Art for All, the Sketchbook School podcast. We will see you again next time. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and leave us a review. And remember, visit sketchbookschool.com and claim your free ebook and your monthly newsletter. Our community is always growing, and we'd love for you to be a part of it. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Art for All.